Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Though it may be hard for young fans of the National Football League to believe, pro football players were not always gigantic. They were not always well paid, and they haven't always had agents. And there was a time when they didn't feel compelled to leap and dance about the field every time they made a tackle. In his new book, Giants Among Men, subtitled How Robustelli, Huff, Gifford, and the Giants Made New York a Football Town and Changed the NFL, Jack Cavanaugh writes about those old days, which he unquestionably regards as good. When we spoke earlier this week, I asked Jack to tell the story of how Andy Robustelli stopped being a Los Angeles Ram and started being a New York Giant, since I think that story establishes some of the distinctions between the NFL then and the NFL now.
Well, one thing it shows very clearly is that management would tolerate no dissent on the part of any players. You had 12 teams, less than 400 players, and you could be an all-pro, as Andy Robustelli was 4 years in a row with the Rams, probably at that time the best team in the NFL and one of the best teams of all time. And yet he was traded because of an affront, if you can call it that. When he had called the new coach of the team, Sid Gilman, in July and said that his wife had given birth to their fourth child in Stamford, Connecticut, and he needed a couple days more at home because he had three young children at home to take care of. And once his wife got home in a few days, he'd leave for camp in Redlands, California. The reaction from Gilman was predictable. I can't worry about anybody's family. I've got a team to worry about here. You be here Monday when you're supposed to be. And he hung up on Andy Robustelli. The very next day, Andy got a call from Wellington Mara, who was, of course, a prominent member of the Mara family, who really was in charge of personnel. And he told Andy, much to Andy's surprise, he got a call from the Rams that Andy was available for trade. Andy was stunned because he'd been all-pro with this great team that had Bob Waterfield, Norm Van Brocklin, Glenn Davis, Crazy Legs Hirsch, all Hall of Famers. Mostly all Hall of Famers. And he was stunned. He liked being with the Rams. Then when he was told by Mara he could be closer to home, they were moving that year in 1956 to Yankee Stadium, 45 minutes away from Robustelli's home in Stamford. And Andy realized, maybe this isn't the worst thing that's ever happened to me.
As regards the relationship between player and team, you write of negotiations, quote, the mechanics simply didn't exist. What did that mean exactly?
Well, they really didn't, because there were no agents to begin with. The players went one-on-one, and all of the players I interviewed about a dozen of the Giants from that era, from 1956 through 1963, and they all agree that the Maras, relatively speaking, were generous. If you asked for another $5,000, they'd probably give it to you. If you asked for another $10,000, you wouldn't get it. But then you got to realize the average salary in the late 50s, early 60s was about $10,000. The best players in the NFL were making around $25,000, $30,000. One of the best quarterbacks of all time, who retired after the 1955 season, quite overlooked, even though he was may have been the greatest quarterback of all time in the NFL, Otto Graham, in his last year made $25,000. Andy told me, as did Alex Webster and a few other players, in all their years with the Giants, they never recall a single player holding out, because there were less than 400 players. There were only 12 teams. And management knew if you didn't bend and come across and agree to their terms, they'd cut you. You could be all pro, they'd cut you. There was somebody else out there with the thousands of good college players who could take your place at a lower price.
You contend that the Giants of 50 years ago demonstrated what you call a rare togetherness, the very essence of the word team. Why should that have been more true of the New York Giants than, say, I don't know, one of the other traditional teams, the Bears, the Browns, some team like that?
I know there will be teams like the ones you mentioned, especially the Browns, who will differ with my contention that the Giants were probably not only the most intelligent, collectively speaking, team, but also the most closely knit. I think it was mainly that didn't happen until 56, when Robustelli came along. Robustelli had been in the Navy in World War II, 3 years aboard a destroyer escort, so a lot of action. Charlie Connolly, the quarterback, had been there since 48, was a Marine in the Pacific. while on patrol in Guam, had a rifle shot out of his hand. These guys were the leaders of the team. You had younger players like Kyle Rote and Frank Gifford, who were almost in awe and had great respect for these guys, for the guys who've been in service. And the players, somehow, they bonded to the degree where at one point about 13 players and the wives lived at the Concourse Plaza Hotel near Yankee Stadium with their children. They would go out to dinner together. The wives would go shopping together, would go into Broadway to see matinees on Wednesday. And the guys also hung out together. After a game, it wasn't uncommon for 14, 15 of the players and their wives to ride the subway from Yankee Stadium all the way down to subway, mind you, not limousine, down to 50th Street, 100 blocks, get on the subway. People would look at them in awe. Frank Gifford, Sam Huff, Charlie doing on a subway with their wives. What are they doing on a subway? Which only cost 10 cents at the time. They go down, they get off the train, walk over to Toots Shores. They would walk into Toots Shores, and they would get a standing ovation from the people at the bar and in the restaurant. It's a difficult thing to put your finger on, say, how did it happen with the Giants? The Maras had a lot to do with it. The Mara family looked for probably three main factors in picking a player with trade or draft. Character was number one. Talent was definitely number two. And to a far lesser degree, experience.
Jim Lee Howell coached the Giants for seven seasons beginning in 1954. Howell didn't have nearly as many assistant coaches as today's NFL coaches have, but two of the guys who were on his staff became household names.
He only had, and it was typical of that era, Bill, he only had four assistant coaches. And his two main coaches, the offensive coordinator was a guy named Vince Lombardi, I'm sure you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And the other main assistant, the defensive coordinator, was a guy named Tom Landry, who a lot of people don't realize. Landry was a very good defensive back. He was all pro. He played with the Giants from 50 to 54. He was an outstanding defensive back. Howell wasn't stupid. Howell was good. He was a leader, had been captain of the Marines and knew how to control men. But he also knew he was smart enough to defer to Lombardi and Landry. He knew they were smarter than he was when it came to football. The saying was that he used to come out and say that all I had to do was make sure the footballs were blown up and decide whether to kick off or receive. As a matter of fact, Cairo tells the funny story. They were training up at St. Michael's College in Vermont. And Kyle was walking down the hallway one night, and he looked to the left, and the door was open, and there was Tom Landry with a projector watching film. He walked a little farther down on the right-hand side, door was open, there's Vince Lombardi, projector going, watching film. Went a little further down, there was Jim Lee Howell lying in bed reading a newspaper.
One of the advantages to playing in New York was the media spotlight, even back then. Linebacker Sam Huff entered that spotlight with a CBS TV special titled The Violent World of Sam Huff. I remember it well when I was a kid. Is it fair to say that on at least one play, the star of the show, Sam Huff, was surprised at how some of the extras were performing?
I think he was, and it's a funny thing I just found out about recently from Don Smith, who had been the PR for the Giants at that time. He said the guy from CBS went to the Giants, met with Don Smith and Wellington Mara, and told him how they wanted to do this documentary. They wanted to call it The Violent World of Andy Robuselli. And Don Smith, who was very friendly with Sam Huff, said, you know, that's not bad, but he said it's not really the best way to do it. He said, if you really want to have a guy who was in on almost every defensive play, it's the middle linebacker, and that was Sam Huff. And he said, beside, the violent world of Sam Huff sounds a lot better than the violent world of Andy Robuselli. He convinced the CBS guy who didn't know much about football.
I was thinking, though, of Huff's surprise when an opposing player named Harlan Hill hit him after the play was over, and Sam Huff's response to that shocking maneuver.
Sam said, Harlan, you never hit anybody so hard in your life. Well, why did you do it to me? And Harlan turned to Sam and said, Sam, I want to get on television. He knew the documentary, which was a preseason game, was being filmed.
You write in your epilogue that by the winter of 1964, the togetherness that had marked the Giants began to come asunder. Was that the fault of management or the fault of the players themselves, or is coming asunder just what happens to all teams eventually, no matter how tight and good they are?
Well, one thing about that, the team did indeed come asunder, and the players, a lot of the players that I interviewed talk to this day, I have never forgiven Allie Sherman. Allie Sherman, who took over as coach of the Giants in 1961, was a very unlikely guy to coach an NFL team. He played at Brooklyn College, not exactly a powerhouse. He wound up in the NFL as a backup quarterback in Philadelphia, only because he knew the T formation and he was teaching the two quarterbacks ahead of him T formation. So Allie became the coach in 61, and Allie kind of had a resentment of the fact that this team was a legacy of Lombardi, Landry, and also Howell, and he wanted to make it in his own image. And so he thought one way to do that was if he saw somebody slowing up even the slightest bit, he traded him. And the first one he traded was the great Rosie Grier. Rosie tended to be overweight, and that could be understood. But then when he traded Huff was devastated. And to this day, Huff has very harsh words for Allie Sherman, because Huff would figure to be untradeable. He was perennial low pro. And they traded Dick Modzelewski, the other tackle, to Cleveland. Totally dismantled the defense. Three of the best defensive players were traded within the course of 2 years. It backfired. That was in 61, 62, 63. They were in the title game for the sixth time in 8 years. They played in Chicago, got beat by the Bears, mainly because Tittle got hurt early. And the next year, the team plummeted. I think they were something like 2-10. And in 64, when that happened, Y.A. Tittle, Andy Robustelli, Frank Gifford, Alex Webster all quit the team. They saw this team was going nowhere. They were getting on in years, although all of them could have played longer. But they realized, no, this isn't the team we remembered, and we're out of here. We don't have much of a defense anymore, and they all retired.
The players from those Giants teams of 40 and 50 years ago with whom you spoke don't much enjoy the NFL today. Why is that?
You know, they're kind of circumspect and discreet when I talk about today's players. And one thing, they do not at all resent the fact that the players make so much money. They said, hey, more power to them. We were in a different era. We didn't make that much money, but a lot of us would have played for nothing. But what they don't like what they see on the field. They can't stand, and some of them, Huff, Sam is so outspoken, you know. And you'd think he wouldn't be, because he still broadcasts the Redskins games on radio. You think he'd be the most circumspect, and he's the most outspoken, but that's Sam Huff. And what they don't like the flamboyance on the field. A guy makes a tackle, he jumps up and down and turns to the crowd like waving his arms so the crowd can applaud him. And Sam said, heck, he's paid to make that tackle. And they just are incredulous at the behavior of the players, and they all say the same thing. They said, you know, that could all be stopped in a heartbeat by, I said, by who? They said the coaches. And if not the coaches, the league, but neither wants to do it because the young fans like it. But these guys, and very few of these guys, you'd be amazed, Tittle, Robustelli, Alex Webster, all these guys I talk to, they practically never go to an NFL game.
Jack Cavanaugh is the author of Giants Among Men, How Robustelli, Huff, Gifford, and the Giants Made New York a Football Town and Changed the NFL. Published by Random House, he joined me from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Jack, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on, Bill.
My conversation with Jack Cavanaugh, author of Giants Among Men, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with Michelle Smith of the San Francisco Chronicle about the women's college basketball season. On the eve of the end of the NASCAR season, we'll introduce you to some of the people who make the cars go, and we'll have a story about how some of the people who knew former pro wrestler Killer Kowalski recently gathered to celebrate his life. It being the advent of the hot stove league season, we'll squeeze in some baseball talk, too. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.